Hear it from the guy who's read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. This is a Guy's Take episode. I hope this title triggers the shit out of people. welcome to the Crypto Economy with Guy Swan. I'm Guy Swan, that is me. The guy who's read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. And I want to talk about, now I am not going to talk about the coronavirus from a, if you're looking for, you know, death counts and percentages and all that bullshit, I don't have the slightest clue. I have, you know, done some personal investigation on Twitter and, you know, a couple of websites and, you know, government reports and some shit like that. But I don't have the slightest clue, and I also don't have any idea what to trust, or have a really good measure of how to compare it to something. Now, a lot of people, I am going to kind of compare it to the flu, and a lot of people seem to be triggered by this. But I do not mean, when I compare it to the flu, I do not mean to belittle the problem at all. If there was suddenly a new flu, I think that's a terrible thing. The flu is not something to be taken lightly. A really bad flu season, and one that we do not have a vaccine for, and that you know, has mutated, that is highly contagious, and many, many people are highly susceptible to, is a giant problem. Particularly, like, since the coronavirus is so novel, like, it is a new virus. It's something that nobody has any, apparently. There's very, very little, if any, natural immunity to it. It's very highly contagious, probably more contagious than the flu. It's gone global in a matter of hours, really. Like in a legitimate sense, it truly went global almost immediately. It's just kind of been slow for us to apparently catch up with our data and assessment and our tests. The biggest fallback right now, or the biggest limitation right now, is our ability to test and figure out where the hell it is, not the fact that the virus has not been able to get places. So when I compare it to the flu, I'm actually trying to do the exact opposite. I think the flu, a really bad and new flu virus, would be a terrible thing for us. And regardless of all of the varying data, it seems like there's pretty decent consensus that this is both a little bit more deadly than the typical flu and also more contagious than the typical flu. Neither one of those is a good thing to have. You know, I had a really good friend, I think it was like last year, the year before, took their daughter to a birthday party. And, you know, all the little kids and all the parents and everything, there's like 30 people or so at this kid's party. And, apparently someone, one of the kids, I believe, brought the flu with them, and nobody really knew, the whole group was basically unaware, but that literally within a couple of days, every single person who was at that party, everyone was just dead sick, out of work, everyone. The flu is nasty. You know, that's not something small, you know, like a company, you know, that has a significant effect in, you know, local economies, in a very, very quick order, you know, very short order. And my mom is a teacher, so I have heard all kinds of crazy shit about sicknesses just sweeping through the school. And like one of her flu seasons, they literally had like almost half of the student body out sick. No joke. That is not something to take lightly, but it is also not something that we should be completely and totally unprepared for. So I want to play a clip real quick. Bruce Fenton actually shared this out, and I probably wouldn't have seen it otherwise. The market response to the coronavirus has been pretty astonishing. So the question is why? What? How did a really bad healthcare problem, which is something that we should be able to expect every decade or so. Like, this is not totally out of the ordinary. We're comparing it to all of these other viruses, SARS and Ebola, and the many bad flu seasons we've had. Why? Because we have all of these things to compare it to. This has happened before. I think we're a little bit more global than we were any time in the past. Like, we are increasingly becoming more and more global. We are increasingly becoming more and more well-connected. So it makes sense that our, I guess you could say, worry and concern about this is way, it's far more exaggerated just because we can see and we can talk about it and we can share it out faster than we've ever been able to before. So there are a lot of things in line to make coronavirus the big disaster seeming that it is. And it's definitely not going to be any fun. But there is a vast chasm between a significant healthcare problem and an economic catastrophe. The question is, why are we so ill-prepared for something like this to happen? And when I say the title of this episode is Coronavirus Bitcoin Fixes This, and if you didn't make it past the headline, for anybody who's going to respond to the argument that they perceive I am going to have in this episode, I will go ahead and preface this, that I am not at all claiming that Bitcoin will stop coronaviruses from happening, that Bitcoin is any sort of an immunity to natural disasters, or that somehow Bitcoin can actually create a vaccine, or that it has any biological effect on the virus or the sickness in any way whatsoever. I am making no such claim. So if somebody says something about that on Twitter or in a response or in a retweet, I promise you, they didn't listen to this episode. But I'm going to lay the groundwork now for what my argument actually is. Now, before I get too off track, though, let's go ahead and hit the video clip that Bruce Fenton shared, because I think it will kind of help to set the stage for where I want to go with this.
Think about how the world would be if you tried to quarantine everybody because of the generic type flu. Now, I'm not saying this is the generic type flu, but maybe we'd be just better off if we gave it to everybody, and then in a month it would be over, because the mortality rate of this probably isn't going to be any different if we did it that way than the long-term picture. But the difference is we're wreaking havoc on global and domestic economies.
So it cuts off a little bit early right there, but he's just saying that this is wreaking global or havoc on the global markets, that this is becoming an economic catastrophe and that we should go ahead and get it over with. Now, there are two incredibly stupid things about what he has said, but there's one very interesting thing about what he said. The incredibly stupid thing is to think that we should all get it at the same time. Like, that's just absolutely insane. And to think that we should not be making some sort of response, like the world medical system would be absolutely overloaded in no time. Like, the amount of buffer that we have to deal with, if Corona is actually, that much, it is in fact worse than the flu and more contagious than the flu, that would be absolutely the dumbest possible thing we could ever do. Like, we would have no hospital beds for anybody. Like, the healthcare supply, everything that we would need to actually extending this out over 2 years is actually a great idea, because we can actually produce the supply to manage that if we have 2 years to basically meet the demand. So the idea is absolutely we should be trying to slow this down as much as possible. This is Rick Santelli, by the way, from CNBC. You may or may not know who he is, but he's been on CNBC, a commentator for, I don't know, as long as I knew CNBC has existed, so. But there is one thing that there is a degree of truth with, for what he says. Thinking that, like, if the consequence is similar to the flu, if it's, oh, we're going to miss 1 or 2 weeks worth of work, let's go ahead and get it out of the way, then it shouldn't be any different if we got, like, let's assume that everything is constant and that we didn't overwhelm the healthcare system, but that we did just all get sick, take 2 weeks off worth of work, and then get back to it. That would not be better than stretching this out over 2 years. What we would technically see is the same loss of productivity stretched over 2 years versus stretched over 2 weeks. That you're still talking about the same number of people out of work for the same amount of time. Clearly, a longer shock would be much, much easier to deal with. This isn't really a tear the Band-Aid off situation. If we are naturally, if we are collectively producing a little bit of excess, like if we actually have surplus, then this should cause almost no problem economically. We should be able to weather this. If we had a month's worth of savings, as an average across the economy, if every company had just enough savings to make it through, you know, a really bad month or a bad half a year, if all of the, you know, average citizens or whatever had some sort of savings to fall back on, had their insurance policy and all this stuff, this is exactly the sort of thing that an economy is designed to buffer us from. And yes, there are always going to be natural disasters that are worse than others. There's always going to, this is not a black swan event. This is a once every decade larger than normal event. But it should absolutely, you can probabilistically prepare for something exactly like this. That is what insurance does. There's a whole industry about protecting against this exact sort of disaster. We recover from horrible hurricanes, from tsunamis, earthquakes, many previous viruses and flus and Ebola and all sorts of stuff. But the tools that are needed are surpluses, savings, a hedge that is backed by real money, not a liability. So how on earth did we go from really bad healthcare problem to global economic catastrophe? I mean, we're in the most technologically advanced economy that we've ever had. Like, it increasingly gets more technologically advanced. We should be more resilient than we have ever been. It is 2020. There's more economic activity online and across border than there has ever been. There should be a greater our ability to stay connected and to travel and move resources faster than ever before should be exactly the thing that is able to correct failures in supply and demand and differences across many different jurisdictions and many different locations. When some group of people has to take off of work, that should be explicitly where the places that have low prices reallocate those resources to the places where now people aren't working. We should be better at dealing with this, not worse. Now, I've actually seen, there's been a couple things really close to home that this market correction has caused problems for. I have a lot of family who's scared shitless about the money they have in the markets. It's looking like my sister's business. I mean, I'm not going to talk about like what she does and like what the business is exactly. But it appears that they made a couple of bad hedges. Also bought a company not too long ago on debts, essentially. And she actually knows this because they've been incredibly open about their finances with their workers because they've had to make cuts and they've basically been very tight. And they have lost a client within the last couple of days. And in doing so, they have had to gut the company. So layoffs across the office. She is still fine right now, but they are in a bad way. She said the whole business right now is like a graveyard, a really depressing graveyard. Like, everybody's like, what are we even doing here now? Like, is this still a company? Like, they're worried the whole thing has gone under, the number of people that are just not in the office anymore. And it's like tons and tons of the management has gone. So it's like just the core producers of their product, essentially. Their product and service that are still around so that they can continue to produce output. But I have no doubt that this is related to the fact that the market has crashed. and that their position, their sustainability, was absolutely connected to it. Now, Ayn Rand actually talks about this quite a bit. This is something that shows up numerous times in the book Atlas Shrugged, if you've ever read it. Some people hate on Ayn Rand a lot, but because I don't totally agree with her philosophy. I think she's wrong about numerous things. But to be perfectly honest, Atlas Shrugged was absolutely essential in me flipping my idea of what money is. That the speech, Francisco D'Antonia's speech about money is just I absolutely loved it. It was absolutely fascinating to me. And it was a huge, huge framing, like mental framing for me as to what money was. I read that like just out of college, I think, or maybe it was my last year in college. I can't exactly remember. But that had a huge effect on me and kind of leading me to Bitcoin and Austrian economics and stuff. Even though she's not really an Austrian theorist, it was without question a piece of the puzzle that led me there. But she talks about the Bolshevik Revolution and sort of the change, the fundamental changes that happened in Russia, and how that increasingly events, natural disasters, all of these things that normally an economy weathers, that normally recovery from takes just a couple of weeks, a couple of months, suddenly started taking much longer. Weeks turned into months, months turned into years, and then sometimes there would just be no recovery at all. And the propaganda, the state, the news, everybody would just blow these terrible events out of proportion. It would be the worst weather event that they've ever had. It's the worst drought they've ever had. Like, everything was just blown way, way out of proportion. And there's actually like an analogy talked about, like there'd be like a rock slide or something that like maintenance and infrastructure would just fall under disrepair, and they would literally just travel back in time. Like a rock slide would destroy like an automatic switching on the train, on like a train system, and they would literally have to stage, like they would have to post men to do manual switching for trains and give manual signaling because all the automatic system went down, or the infrastructure to send the electricity went down. And they would literally go back in time, and they couldn't recover from it. That as the economy became more and more centrally managed, as the role of money to communicate value continued to break down further and further, that the infrastructure, the technology, the systems, everything started to break down. And where there was a major natural disaster that that the economy recovered from quickly, there was just no recovery. And we are seeing that. I think I've seen that over the course of my life. Like, there were always bad hurricanes and bad floods. I mean, I live in North Carolina. North Carolina is, if you look at the coast of the United States, hurricanes are always going up, you know, Florida, just cruising up that East Coast, just blasting the hell at everything on the East Coast of the United States. And North Carolina is just sticking its big ass nose out and just begs to be hit by every one of them. North Carolina and Florida are always demolished. So that is nothing new. And like when some of those, like when I was younger and like a big, really bad hurricane would come, Floyd, Bertha, Fran, all these hurricanes over the years. I had so many hurricanes throughout my life, I couldn't even count them. And every single time, it felt like the end of the world. But, you know, a couple of weeks, couple of months go by, everybody calls in their insurance plans, everybody rebuilds. The things that don't get rebuilt get squished and cleared out, and somebody builds something new in its place. It gets sold for, you know, fire sale prices because, you know, they couldn't maintain it anymore. All the imbalance gets corrected. But just a couple years ago, or maybe last year, actually, there was a really bad hurricane in Wilmington, North Carolina, which was particularly bad because the flooding was awful. And it laid waste. Wilmington is an incredibly low city. I lived there for a number of years. And it would always, if a big flood, big hurricane, big rains, big hurricane came in, just flooding like crazy. Some entire shopping centers would have a foot of water in them. And it was always bad like that. I went back there a couple of months after this hurricane, and they're kind of the heart of the city. There was a lot that had recovered, but I was truthfully shocked at how much of the city had basically just been abandoned. Areas that were gas stations that I used to go to, neighborhoods that used to be kind of nice, just looked disgusting and barely, just as if they were never cleaned up, like they just dried after the hurricane and that was basically it. And I was really kind of blown away. I was like, you know, it's been 5 months, you know, it's 6 months, whatever it was. How is this still in this state? And Ayn Rand goes into this kind of principle, this reality of the incentives when you politicize the economy, that when money is basically destroyed as a function of pricing, as a mechanism for, you know, creating a buffer of risk. Like, that's a lot of, even though the role of money is in exchange, it's in an economic good that can account for productivity, account for and measure productivity to make it so that we have a totem, essentially, to value one thing against another that might be completely unrelated or have no, you know, shared industry or production tree. It's like we need that medium, that language that bridges the gap between these vastly different items. How the hell do you measure a car in bananas, right? That's really difficult to do. But with money, I know the price of bananas. I know the price of cars in relation to the good, in relation to the money. And therefore, I have a clear number that says, okay, a banana is worth 1/100,000th of a car, or whatever the hell it is. And when that starts to break down, when you centralize an economy, when you start to centrally manage it, you lose the ability for that to actually be true, for the price of the banana and the price of the car to actually be the relative values of the two items. And then you have these growing imbalances. You have these growing debts. You have, like I said, the tools for surviving, for not having an economic crisis when these things happen, are savings. They're hedges that are backed by real value. They are excess and surplus production, not losses. They are not, it is to not have debts to pay off, so that if you lose a little bit of production, it's just a little bit of loss of production. It's not a loss of the production plus the massive interest rate that you cannot pay on the debts that you are holding. Now, if anybody has even a cursory glance of the state of our economy, you would know that we have none of those tools available to us. We have no savings. We have a staggering amount of debt. Significantly over half of my demographic has less than $1,000 in savings. Last I looked at it was somewhere between like 60 and 70%, I think. Overall, all the major companies are at multiples of their GDP now. China is like, as far as debts go, overall debts. France, UK, Japan, like a lot of the modern nations are somewhere between like 120 and 200% of their GDP in debt. The US, I think, is right around 150, 180, somewhere around. I can't remember exactly what the number is, and I haven't checked recently, but it's all in that range. There are no, you don't have to worry, it's not 20%, it's not 50%. I'm not off by much by whatever it actually is. While the average, just if you take the total number divided by, you know, the amount of private, like consumer debt, it's somewhere like, it's over 10,000. It's like 12,000, 13,000, something like that. All while we have, you know, $1,000 in savings. Our entire stock market is backed by liabilities if you've ever seen that chart of the unicorn club, of the how many companies in the last like 3 or 4 years have become billion-dollar companies, and then the number of them that project and report losses every quarter, yet the money they get is so cheap that they get loaned money to them, that they take out a loan and then buy their own stock. They've been doing stock buybacks to raise the valuations of all of these companies like crazy, and people are so desperate for yield that they've been putting their money into these companies, and they know that all of this cheap money is going to be available. We have a hedge backed by real value. We don't have it anywhere. We have it nowhere. It's all backed by liabilities. Our money is backed by liabilities. New money is issued as a debt. So all the tools that we need to weather something exactly like this, we don't even have 2 weeks worth of savings. We don't have it. How did we get here? How did we reach this point? How are we so economically weak that the potential of losing 2 weeks collectively of productivity spells global economic catastrophe? Let's take a break and hit our sponsor. And I want to talk about, from the Austrian perspective, I want to talk about all of the things I would do to kill an economic giant. How would I create and instill over decades a powerful economic weakness? How would I engineer it so that something like the coronavirus could come along and destroy a country? What would I do? I want to talk about that. Let's take a break real quick and hit our sponsor. All right, so let's get back into this. So our problem here is we've got massive economic weakness. We have none of the tools available to us to essentially recover quickly from this disaster. And none of the tools and productivity that we need to cover a gap in exactly that, our productivity. In fact, we have massive debts to pay off. So what we do is we lose 2 weeks of paying off debt rather than having to dip into 2 weeks worth of savings. And now we have this huge healthcare disaster that is threatening our productivity, threatening, you know, everybody's health, could overload the health system, could cause all these sorts of problems, and we are woefully unprepared for it. So where did the foundation of that come from? Now, I want to read something from the money speech in Atlas Shrugged, which is one of my favorite speeches ever. Totally unrealistic, mind you. It's Francisco, the character Francisco, at this like big dinner party. And he just stands in the middle of this party and is allowed to basically lecture everybody for like a 10-page speech or something. But it is beautiful, and I'm so glad that they unrealistically let him speak because I love it. There's just a little part of the quote. "You stand in the midst of the greatest achievements of the greatest productive civilization, and you wonder why it's crumbling around you, while you're damning its lifeblood money. You look upon money as the savages did before you, and you wonder why the jungle is creeping back to the edge of your cities." The whole speech is amazing, but my brother actually reminded me of this little section of the jungle creeping back to the edge of your cities. And that's what I think we have. The jungle is creeping back in, and we're trying to find out why. So let's do a thought experiment. What if I was in charge of the economy? We've got a centralized economy. Let's say I'm the one who centralized it, and I get to dictate everything that goes on, but I still have to kind of, you know, be politically relevant. You know, I can't just do anything. I have to do something that I can easily excuse. And how, from an Austrian perspective, would I go about if I knew that in 20 years we were going to have this really, really terrible virus that we did not foresee, And I wanted it to cause as much damage as possible to the economy. What would I do? First thing, absolutely, debts. I would incentivize the hell out of people going into debt. I would immediately take control of the interest rate. And I would come up with a really good excuse that, whatever it is, I need to control the economy. It's the general excuse. I need to control interest rates so that we can balance out volatility and animal instincts of the market economy. Without my wise direction, how would we do anything? So immediately, lower interest rates. More people will go into debt. And I'll have the second added benefit, the second very, very critical point, part of the puzzle, is to get rid of savings, is to wipe out savings as much as possible. Wipe it out from the culture, wipe it out make sure there's just no supply. There's no supply of real money. And I would also make sure that any loaned money was indistinguishable. Loaned money that was not backed by anything was indistinguishable from the rest of the money. It wouldn't be a debt token at a bank. It wouldn't be specific to a bank. I would give banks the right, the authority, to issue debts simply backed, or to issue money simply backed by the promise to return the money. This encourages any sort of imbalance to cascade very, very quickly through the economy rather than creating buffers. You can think of savings and you can think of reserves. Both savings in the context of like any person who has $10,000 in savings as opposed to $200 in savings, and then any reserve that is backing a loan that someone can't pay off if the bank has the reserve, both of those things act like a sort of fire break in the economy. So if someone defaults on their debt, but the person who is owed $5,000 on the debt has $10,000 in savings, well, then they take a really bad hit. But that buffer comes out and it doesn't even go to the next person. It doesn't extend to the next, the domino doesn't hit the next domino because we had a $10,000 buffer for a $5,000 problem. Probably the closest thing it would do was that, let's say this person had a couple of employees or, a couple of luxuries that they were taking advantage of, and, they cancel a couple of luxuries and they're a little bit tight on their business for a month or two, but they run a surplus. They're profitable, they're productive, and they clear everything back out in a couple of months, they're right back where they started. So maybe the next person, maybe the employee has to dip a little bit into savings or cut a luxury or two, but it does not cascade very far. The dominoes have big gaps between them, and some of them don't reach because we have savings. Same with a bank. If there's actually reserve for the loans that are made, well, then the bank is just out reserves. They're just footing the bill for the loan that they made, the bad loan that they made. But if their reserves are the debts of the next bank, well, then the next bank goes with them. Now imagine you have something like fractional reserve. This would be critical to making sure that it cascades through the economy as quickly and as painfully as possible, that every debt is actually backed by a multiple of other debts, that is only a fraction of reserve that is actually there, and that fraction is indeed backed by yet another debt in a new place. This is like, instead of having fire breaks, that you just occasionally, just when any of the brush is like a little bit weak, you just pour a bunch of gasoline just in case, so that if the fire was ever going to slow down, you don't have that problem. Remember, we're trying to engineer this thing so that the entire jungle goes up in flames all at once. That's what we're trying to do. It is an economy is an organic thing. So we want to make sure that all of those organisms are deeply tied to each other, that the cascading failures of one turns into the poison that fails the next one. We want that brush tight. We want no fire breaks. We want the fire to go as fast and as hard as possible. So that's stage one. And that already gets us there. And you have to do this slowly. You know, like if you push the interest rate down too far too fast, well, then what you end up with is the imbalance goes, first you have this incredible overheated period and then this glorious crash. But you don't want that. You want to spread it out. So you just slightly lower it below the market rate. And another really good thing to do, especially if you now have, this is me. I'm the one that's doing this. So I now have monopoly control over the money. What else am I going to do? I'm going to start subsidizing things. I'm going to subsidize certain skills. We have a very limited amount of labor. We have a very limited amount of time for each individual person. And it is very critical that we have accurate prices for what skills we should take the time to learn. If the market only has the capital available or only has the demand available for 10 people to learn a skill, well, I want to subsidize it a little bit to make sure that 20 people learn the skill so that when those imbalances can last for quite some time, the market economy, particularly with my subsidy, might be able to sustain 20 people doing that job for a short period of time without people realizing how out of balance it is, that we're 100% out of balance in this tiny little industry. And my subsidy keeps it alive. But what it means is that the transition away from it, when any sort of correction finally comes, is going to be even more painful because those 10 people now have to readjust their entire skill set. They don't have to just find a new job. They don't just have to sell off their bad assets. They actually have to relearn how to be productive because they learned to be productive in a market that didn't need them. So I would subsidize schooling that had no market. I would subsidize all sorts of skills. I would subsidize all sorts of industries that were dying. I'd subsidize the shit out of newspapers. I would subsidize taxis. I would subsidize notepads and physical pencils. Everything that I thought was going to not be here in 10 years, that the economy can no longer sustain this incredibly wasteful, I would subsidize shovels and I would tax tractors. I would make sure that the past was subsidized so that the transition was delayed, because then I get to build up another imbalance. I get to build up too many people getting paid too much to do the job that they are no longer needed to do. And again, at the same time, to try to help these economies out, I'll give them cheaper debt. You know, I'll give certain skills lower debts. I'll keep, you know, kind of ticking that interest rate down. And eventually we're going to have some sort of correction. But right now I've decreased savings significantly, and that is going to get worse and worse over time. It's going to get into the culture, and you know, your grandmother might have saved a lot. Your parents might have saved about half that. You're going to save about half that. Like, this is going to get progressively worse as we get a couple of generations of doing this, and I'm going to keep doing it. It's just going to be like clockwork. Just, you know, how you kill a giant, how you, you know, dig through, you know, 1,000 yards of concrete. You do it, just chip it away one day at a time. Just tiny little increments until you get through the whole thing. You just need time. And now I'm subsidizing industries that should have died. I'm subsidizing wasteful and inefficient things. I'm subsidizing skills that the market doesn't even want. All very, very important. Now, inevitably, there are going to be corrections along the way. There are going to be downturns where, what is an economic correction? What is that job? It's not the job. It's not the job of an economic correction. But what role does it eventually play in hindsight in an economy? What does it do? It kills irresponsible companies. It puts people out of business who didn't have savings. It punishes the irresponsible and the frivolous, and it rewards the savers and the frugal. So when an economic correction comes, what I need to do is I need to find the largest companies, just because they're the only ones that are going to be politically viable. I can really, you know, build up a scare as to how devastating it would be to have these companies go out of business. And I need to find the ones that are most poorly positioned, the ones with the most debt, who have the greatest amount of irresponsibility, and I'll bail them out. That's very important. I want to make sure that the bad behaviors that the irresponsible bankers and financiers, the ones that had no reserves, that had no savings, get bailed out so that I sustain that bad behavior. Otherwise, people will correct. Otherwise, people will adapt. They'll be punished for being stupid and irresponsible, and I don't want that. I want to destroy this economic giant, not make it healthy. So I'm definitely going to bail out all of the big irresponsible financial institutions. That's a given. It has to happen. And I'm definitely not going to bail out anybody with savings. I can't do it across the board because then kind of the key imbalance that I'm trying to create here is kind of lost. I want to make sure that the responsible people have to pay for it themselves, and that I am pulling the money, I'm pulling the value out of their savings accounts by devaluing the money in order to pay for the irresponsible. And even more so is that I will give loans to these companies. I want to give loans to all these big irresponsible companies and all the big corporate partnerships and stuff. And it's also really important too for me politically because I need to stay in power. So obviously they're the people that I want to give money to because they're going to have the greatest reach, you know, from a propaganda standpoint, from a convince people that I'm the good guy sort of view. So this is really great all the way, all around. Like, it's a really easy sell. But if I give them loans, well then, great thing. They're going to be able to buy up all of the small responsible people that are now suffering from all of this, all the smaller companies, and will consolidate into the large irresponsible companies that are, you know, corrupt and frivolous and leveraged out the ass. And this is great because the fewer businesses that are outside of this irresponsible behavior, well, then the bigger and fewer my dominoes are and the closer together they are. And I do this again over years and years. Maybe we go through 2-3 contractions and I just keep bailing out all the most important, quote unquote, irresponsible businesses. And that becomes a trend. If I do that 2 times, 3 times, you know, through some contractions over that 20, 25 year period, whatever it is, well, then even better is that I'm going to, as a consequence, I'm going to get the benefit of having created more of that irresponsible behavior. Not only have I saved the ones that are irresponsible, but all the other companies that see that if they're big enough, they could get bailed out, they're going to copy. They're going to copy and paste. They're going to be like, okay, well, these guys are successful by doing it this way. Let's go ahead and make sure that we have a politician. Let's get on guy's good side. And, you know, and then we'll get the subsidies. Let's reach out and get a lot of these damn subsidies. Let's invest in all these skills that the market doesn't need. Let's set up a bunch of newspapers and, you know, pencil factories. And then if we get big enough, he'll bail us out. And we just need to do the exact same debts and, you know, terrible policies as these other companies. Another really important factor in all of this. And I'm doing a great job so far. I've destroyed savings. I have successfully drowned my little society in debts. I have essentially cut out all the fire breaks, or I've just planted seeds and, you know, fertilized with gasoline all of the fire breaks that we used to have. Tried to make sure we got as few of those as possible. All my dominoes are very tightly together. They're getting bigger and bigger. I'm making sure that the bad companies and the bad business practices don't go out of business. I have sent millions and millions of people and tens of millions, hundreds of millions, billions of man hours wasted. I've sent them in the wrong direction, made them waste resources on skills we don't need, on production the market doesn't even want, to sustain industries that are just waiting to die, that should have died 10 years ago, but I'm keeping them up so that rather than dying slowly over a period of 10 years, we'll have to do it all at once when the, you know, coronavirus shows up, or whenever my natural disaster that I want to be my catalyst for this collapse to actually unfold. And of course, I have done this all at the expense of the savers, at the expense of the truly productive. And I have made sure to limit the value return of those who made the correct decisions. The people who invested in the right skills are actually positioned to make less money because I am taking the money from them. I want to do everything in my power to make sure that the relationship, the comparative price between the good that the market is actually needing, that actually in demand for, and the market, and the good that nobody needs and the market actually isn't demanding, is not the large ratio that it actually is supposed to be. And therein lies another strategy, actually. There's a lot of little soft things I can do to help out these barriers. How can I just make it, as in technology increases and as we become more connected, we become more and more mobile in our ability to shift what we do economically. So I want to also put resistance on that. What can I do there? One good thing is I could enact soft price controls, and I could enact small costs on specific things. The goal here is to just make sure, again, like the example where I wanted 20 people learning a skill that the market could only sustain 10 people of, I want to kind of do the same, that same thing across production. I want to make the market able to only sustain 8 as opposed to 10. And how do I do that? I implement a 20% cost on that skill that's actually desirable. So, and just create little barriers all over the place. Great idea. Let's make sure that anybody who's braiding hair has to get a $200 license. That'll help. I'll, you know, push out 30% of the supply of hair braiders if I can pay a whole bunch of police. And let's prop up the police while we're at it. Let's go ahead and hire 20 or 30% more police so that they can go arrest all the people who do not have licenses for braiding hair. I want to make sure that, you know, they don't just ignore the rules. So let's go ahead and put in licenses for dog walking, licenses for mowing lawn, for putting up a lemonade stand. Little costs all over the place. And maybe put in little price controls too. Let's say that, you know, like prices adjust seasonally, like 20% or something for some typical good. Let's put in a price that just, you know, anti-price gouging, you know, those evil price gougers, such an easy political sell. But let's make sure that if anybody moves the price, it can only be within, it can only be 5% or only 10% in a 6-month period. So that if we get hit with a lot of inflation or we get hit with a shift in production, well, I'm going to make sure that there's just a little bit less supply. The scarcity is going to go up just a little bit, and we're not going to quite meet demand. And I'm going to consistently do this. I'm going to stack these on top of each other. Let's get hundreds of thousands of pages of these little bullshit laws, these little barriers, all of this stuff. Now, another good set of rules that I can do to create a lot of potent weakness in the economy, bundle stuff together. We don't want people getting health care from getting their own health care, getting their own insurance from a different company, getting their retirement from some other situation, doing their own savings, and having a job and a side business. We want to aggregate as much of this as possible. So let's require businesses provide all of these. This gives me two benefits. One, I get a bunch of new barriers. I get a bunch of added costs to running a business, which will prevent more people from actually providing a business. And the fewer businesses we have, again, the bigger the dominoes, the closer they are together. This is another great thing for me. But if, let's say, they have to provide the retirement, the employer has to provide retirement. They have to provide savings accounts. They have to provide health insurance. They have to provide life insurance, medical, like eye and dental and all this stuff. Let's bundle as much stuff as possible into a job. And now we've raised the barrier to creating a business, and we've also raised the barrier to leaving your job, so that this makes people desperate, so that they're just completely trapped to their job. And even worse is now they have no savings, so they have no buffer. They have no leveraging power against their employer. You know, if you had 3 months worth of savings, well, then you could be like, fuck off, employer. You're not paying me enough. And you could spend 2 months trying to find another job. And until somebody gave you a good offer, you're cruising. You're fine. I got savings. I got no debt. But luckily, I've already done that. I've destroyed their savings account, and I've made sure that they're way, way, way into debt. And then I've lowered interest rates again and, you know, sold them on going deeper into debt. But then I've also raised the barrier to leaving the business. Now, if they're an employee, now they don't just lose their job. They lose their health care. They lose their insurance. I mean, God, it'd be great if I could just attach housing to the employers. That would be wonderful if I could make it so that they had to pay for the apartment or maybe everybody's Netflix and, you know, cable and internet subscription. Ooh, even better. Then I've basically made slaves. This is wonderful. This is perfect because all of them are going to be utterly screwed if the economy starts to cascade. And I've made sure that if it starts to cascade, it will cascade to the very end. That the jungle will burn wholly and completely from start to finish in one giant inferno. I have successfully engineered something that will kill an economic giant. I have set the stage to burn the world to the ground, and all I need is a match. One match. Whether you call that coronavirus, you call it a hurricane, you call it a tsunami, you just need one catalyst to set this thing on fire. And if it's not quite ready yet, well, let's just double down on all of our policies. Let's bail them out again. Let's push them more into debt. Let's go negative interest rates. Let's loan more people more money. Let's devalue savings again. All we have to, it's inevitable. You know, if it's like not quite there and I don't think the destruction is going to be bad enough, well, just keep doing the same thing until it's ready. And eventually another coronavirus will come along. Another tsunami will come along. And then I'll get that inferno that I was looking for. If you got the idea, and if you were following me, you know this is exactly what almost the entirety of the modern financial world has been doing for like 50 years. This is exactly the situation we are in. Now, I don't think the whole economy is going to burn to the ground. We do. We are productive. And despite our imbalances, we are more well-connected and more mobile than we ever have. We can even learn skills faster than we've ever been able to. But we also have all those problems that I just laid out as being excellent weapons for ruining our situation. The only one that I'm sorry that they didn't attach to was that employers should provide housing. That would be great. God, that would just put the icing on the cake, wouldn't it? But luckily, at least we have healthcare and insurance. Takes it to the jugular, you know, when somebody loses their job. So a downturn in the economy, ooh, they're going to come running to me and they're going to need to be bailed out. It's going to be great. Like, this is just going to kind of go on its own, you know, like I'm just going to be able to kind of turn this machine on and it's going to run itself afterward. Because I've made the situation so bad that the only thing that we can do is all of the things I've done to worsen the situation. So I'll have generations after me repeating my terrible policies and idiotic process. Without them having even any idea what's going on. Now, all this said, I don't think this is actually engineered. I don't think this is on purpose. This is just the incentives. This is what the incentives of a government-managed economy produce. And all of this is fixed by Bitcoin. Bitcoin makes all of this vastly more difficult to do. It is through the control of money. It is through the destruction of the role of money, and it is unsound money that causes the jungle to creep back to the edge of the cities. Sound money, Bitcoin, will not solve the coronavirus, but it will ensure that the next time one comes around, we can weather the storm. Our price signals will be accurate as to where we need resources. Our savings will provide fire breaks so that the dominoes, the fire, does not cascade through the entire jungle. Our reserves will ensure that one debt doesn't hit the next debt, and that debt doesn't hit the following one. And when insurance has to sell assets, it doesn't cause a stock market crash. It causes reserves to be called due. It doesn't destroy the value of these companies. It doesn't destroy our productivity. We'll actually have surpluses to work from. So when, you know, we lose 5% of our productive capacity for a short span of time, well, we were producing 5% extra. So we just break even this year. The coronaviruses of the world are simply going to happen. The question is whether or not we can survive them. That is my argument for why Bitcoin fixes this. All right, so that'll do it for today. I hope you guys enjoyed this. I should just start calling these guys rant. And I hope I didn't scare you too much about the coronavirus. You know, we are in an incredibly like mobile and a resilient economy despite all of this. I mean, we have set the stage for a huge correction, but at the same time, the internet, the technology, Bitcoin, so many of the things that have actually been built in the face of this actually give us an escape valve for all of this extra pressure. We actually are rebuilding our fire breaks in spite of all the manipulation, price controls, subsidies, bailouts, etc., etc. Despite the fact that we've had a perfect storm against us, the economy has been astounding at still finding the true information. It's truly a testament to the organism of the human markets that we have still built correcting tools. So I don't think this is going to be the disaster that a lot of people are making it out to be. And I'm not downplaying the coronavirus, but also I'm not trying to scare the crap out of anybody. I'm not super worried about it. I think to put life on hold because something might happen, I think is a terrible idea. I am working under normal conditions, and I'm just trying to stop touching my face, and I'm going to wash my hands. So there it is. That's my position on that. And I wish we were better economically prepared, but that's, what do you do? You buy Bitcoin. That's it. So that's where we are. Bitcoin fixes this, and hopefully we will go back to a sound money, robust, resilient economy. We'll emerge out of this, and we will finally correct all of this corruption and irresponsible behavior that has been needing to be punished for so very long. With that, thank you guys so much for listening. I love you all. I hope you guys have a wonderful, wonderful weekend. I will be back here next week with another episode of The Crypto Economy. And until then, take it easy, guys. We'll be right back.